50 years ago, the United States Supreme Court handed down what may be the most important decision of the 20th century. Brown v. Board of Education declared in May 1954 that separate education facilities are inherently unequal. Separate but equal would no longer be the law of the land. To explain this historic event and its 50-year aftermath, we have James T. Patterson, history professor at Brown University and the author of Brown v. Board of Education, A Civil Rights Milestone and Its Troubled Legacy, published recently by Oxford University Press. We're talking with Professor Patterson today from his Providence, Rhode Island office. Welcome, Jim Patterson.
Thank you for having me.
Let's begin by setting the stage for this decision. What was America like in 1954, especially when it came to issues of race?
Well, it was, of course, the Jim Crow era of segregation in the South and in the border states and in some other states. It separated blacks and whites in those states by law, as opposed to the de facto segregation which often existed elsewhere. In all of these states, for instance, with regard to schools, which is what the Brown case concerned, of course, there were 17 states that required the racial separation and segregation of black and white students, and four other states, including Kansas, which is where the Brown case came from, which permitted local areas in the state to impose it. This affected millions of children and was the anchor, really, of the much larger Jim Crow segregation system, which affected not only schools but everything else, public accommodations, restaurants, hotels, even drinking fountains and telephone booths. So it was a very harsh system of separation, which also carried with it discrimination, which is to say the separate but equal facilities were separate but unequal.
And that would certainly apply to schools,
unequal.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit,
examples? In the South, for instance, in the 11 states of the old Confederacy, it was estimated in the early 50s, when this litigation was reaching the Supreme Court, that the black schools in the South received about 60% as much per pupil as the white schools did. And I should point out that the white schools in the South generally were much poorer than the schools outside of the South. So these were very, very poor schools, often without central heating, leaky roofs, tar paper roofs, wood stoves, poorly educated teachers, very dated hand-me-down textbooks, and so forth, and very crowded facilities. It was very difficult to get any kind of a decent education in most of those schools. And in my book, I'm not very nostalgic about these places.
Right. You said earlier that these schools were really the anchor of a much larger system. Can you elaborate on that? And is that some of the reason why the civil rights movement or the NAACP decided to focus on schools?
They focused on schools. Originally, they focused in the 1930s and 40s on graduate schools, which they correctly understood were less sensitive since this was not involving young children. But in the late 40s and early 50s, they switched from a strategy of demanding equality, that is to say, demanding equal within a separate system, to a challenge on segregation itself. That decision was made by the NAACP and the Legal Defense Fund, which was its litigating arm, in 1950, and it took another 4 years before the Supreme Court reached the decision. The schools were always the most sensitive area of race relations. The civil rights movement later on made wonderful strides in wiping out segregation and Jim Crow and discrimination in, for instance, public accommodations, voting, things of that sort. But resistance to school desegregation from the beginning up until the present day has been powerful in the South.
Why was that so?
I think it's mainly because parents, black parents as well as white parents, but here we're talking about the resistance of white parents, understandably care about their children and their children's education above practically all other things. And as we know, people move to places, if they can afford it, where they anticipate that their kids are going to get a good education. So faced with the thought or the danger, as many whites saw it, of black kids joining their own kids in desegregated schools, many white parents thought that their children's education would suffer, And behind that, there was always the deep fear of social interaction, dating, interracial sex, marriage, and so forth, which was something that young children, teenagers in particular, of course, would be in danger of getting involved in. So it was a lot easier for whites, when forced by the civil rights legislation of the 60s, to accept eating in the same restaurant or staying in the same hotel or waiting in the same line in a public building or going into a swimming pool or a beach or a park or voting or getting on a bus, as was the fight in Montgomery with Martin Luther King in 55, 56. All of these things were contested, but not nearly so strongly or so lastingly as desegregation of the schools.
Right. One of the main characters in your book, Brown v. Board of Education, is Thurgood Marshall, a name familiar certainly to older Americans. But can you introduce him to us and tell him why he's such an important figure here?
Yes, Marshall was raised in Baltimore and of what would then have been considered a middle-class black family. His mother was a school teacher. His father was a steward and a waiter in an all-white club. So he had a little better start in life than the vast majority of blacks who matured in the 1920s. He went to a black university and then tried or thought of going to the University of Maryland Law School. But, of course, it was segregated and he couldn't get in. So he went to the Howard Law School in Washington, D.C., which it turned out was a major trainer of some of the leading black attorneys of the 1930s and 40s. And he got out of law school in the early 30s and immediately joined the NAACP and later headed the Legal Defense Fund in the late 30s and was known as Mr. Civil Rights by the late 1940s because of all of his efforts on behalf of fighting discrimination, not just schools. They had a lot of cases involving military service and rape and criminal cases, but increasingly the school issue became the most important one by the late 40s.
And just to look ahead quickly here, he does go on, of course, to a national career in a different venue later on.
Oh, yes. He's, of course, the first black Supreme Court justice appointed by Lyndon Johnson in 1967. And he served until 1990 or 91, I can't remember which. And his place as, quote, the black justice was then taken by Clarence Thomas.
Right. Something that is his appointment in 67, something that would have been unimaginable in 1954, I assume.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. You're quite right.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about this decision that we call Brown v. Board of Education. What was it? Just a summary of it, please.
Well, it was actually five cases. There were five cases that came up through the courts, the best known of which is the Brown case, named after Oliver Brown, the father of Linda Brown, a black third grader who was segregated in the Topeka elementary schools. And it was, as I say, it had a long and characteristically long course of getting to the Supreme Court, which actually heard argument. It's on it twice. And as you said earlier, the decision was finally made in May of 1954. And what it said was that state-sponsored segregation of schools was unconstitutional. And the assumption, therefore, was that down the road they would be desegregated. The court, however, was very, very sensitive to the anticipated Southern white resistance. And they did not say anything in the 1954 decision as to how or when this desegregation process would be carried out. They waited another year, heard more arguments about it, and made a decision in May of 1955, which said that desegregation should be carried out, this famous phrase, with all deliberate speed. And this is one of the most confusing and really unhelpful phrases in the history of the Supreme Court, because speed, of course, means rapidly, deliberate means with deliberation, take your time. And in any event, the South did take its time and fiercely resisted the Brown versus Board decisions. The first one's usually called Brown Rule Numeral 1, and the second one Brown Rule Numeral 2 in 1955. And it wasn't until the very late 60s and early 70s that teeth was finally put into this decision, and some desegregation took place in these southern states. In fact, in May of 1964, 10 years after the original decision, only about 1% of black public school students the decision that covered only public schools. In the South, in the 11 states of the old Confederacy, were going to school with whites.
So clearly the deliberate word is more important than the speed word in that
In terms of what
aftermath.
Happened, yes.
Yeah. Can you tell us more about that reaction, that resistance from white Americans, white Southerners in particular?
Well, it ranged the gamut from violence. There were some violent responses, although when you think of the extent of the opposition, the violence was rather minor. But there were all kinds of other ways of getting around the decision, which we really haven't time to talk about. But essentially, one favorite tactic was pupil placement laws. Education in this country was, and even now, is pretty much of a local phenomenon, supported by local tax dollars and operated, administered through local school districts. And what these local people would do, in the South, for instance, and in some of the border states, is decide that after Brown to place students according to various academic or psychological categories, which they developed, all of which miraculously had the effect of placing all the whites in some schools and all the blacks in the other schools. And when challenged about this, they would say, "We're not doing this racially. This is just the way the ball drops."
Right.
And they got away with this. That was just one of the many ruses until, as I say, the court finally clamped down on these. And another method was freedom of choice plans, where the school district would say to the parents, you're free to go wherever you want. But very few black parents dared send their kids into the all-white schools in most places.
Right.
And so the freedom of choice plans really didn't accomplish anything.
What about the president at the time, Dwight Eisenhower? Just briefly, what was his reaction to Brown v. Board of Education?
Eisenhower was, I think, a principled conservative on most matters, including race relations, if you can be principled and resist rapid desegregation as he did. He really believed that the only way race relations were going to improve and that segregation would be done away with would be in the long spread of time as local people became more tolerant and worked things out. He, like many conservatives, he did not believe that government, particularly the federal government, should be imposing these decisions.
Did he use the White House bully pulpit, however?
Not really, no. He did desegregate some government facilities, such as veterans hospitals and the sort, and tried to get the District of Columbia schools to desegregate. But he didn't. He never endorsed the Brown decision. He said the Supreme Court has made its decision, and because that's now the law of the land, I will support it. But he never used the bully pulpit. The closest you could say that he came to doing that was in the Little Rock crisis of 1957. Mm. And here he did finally send federal troops into Little Rock in order to desegregate Central High School. But he did so belatedly, very reluctantly, and on the grounds that his commander-in-chief, the resistance that the state of Arkansas and the city of Little Rock had undertaken to prevent desegregation in 1957 was a direct challenge to the federal authority.
Yes.
But he never justified it on the grounds that segregation was immoral or wise, or that desegregation was wise.
In just the few seconds we have left, Jim, can you answer a tough question 50 years later? Is America better because of Brown?
Well, it's certainly better, much better, because of the desegregation which followed in the wake of Brown. Yes, I think so. You find a lot of people today, including a number of black people, who feel that desegregation of schools has not accomplished much, and many black parents would prefer to send their, it's a minority, but some would prefer to send their kids to predominantly black schools run by predominantly black educators. But in a general way, the constitutional doctrine of desegregation, which began in an important way with the Brown decision in 1954, was then extended to desegregation of all ways and manners of life. And
yes.
That's got to be a great improvement.
Well, thank you very much, Jim. James Patterson, Brown University, talking about his book, Brown v. Board of Education, A Civil Rights Milestone and Its Troubled Legacy, published by Oxford University Press. Thank you, Jim.
Many thanks.